It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, your office holiday party might be serving less alcohol this year. A human resource expert tells us how workplace year-end events are changing and why.
First, it's time for our weekly look at national politics. We're talking about the results of last night's special Senate election in Alabama, a tentative tax deal between House and Senate Republicans, and a feud between President Trump and a female Democratic senator.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Democrat Doug Jones defeating Republican Roy Moore in Alabama? Does it mean Republicans should be making changes ahead of next year's midterms? Do you see the results as a referendum on President Trump? Let us know right now by calling 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. She joined us now from Washington, D.C. Sabrina, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, let's start with the big news from Alabama. Last night, Democrat Doug Jones defeated Republican Roy Moore by just over 20,000 votes at latest count. Here's a listen to Jones during his acceptance speech last night.
This vote, I've said it before, Alabama has been at a crossroads. We have been at crossroads in the past. And unfortunately, we have usually taken the wrong fork. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, you took the right road.
Sabrina, if someone had come on the show about a year ago or so, or a year and a half ago, and said, hey, sometime in the next 10 years, a pro-choice Democrat is going to represent Alabama in the U.S. Senate, we probably wouldn't have called that guest back. That seems pretty out there. And yet, here we are today.
Well, I made the prediction yesterday, foolishly, that I thought we would be talking about Senator-elect Roy Moore this morning. And I should have learned the lesson to make my exit from the prediction business in last year's presidential race. But here we are.
And the big thing is people are trying to draw lessons from it. And I know it's safer not to try to draw too many lessons from one election outcome. But what are some of the let's start with the Republican side of thing. And there's some blame game going on. What kind of back and forth are we seeing among Republicans after yesterday?
Well, I think you're right to point out that you can't draw too many conclusions from one singular race, especially when one of the candidates on the ballot was accused of sexually assaulting women and, in some cases, molesting underage girls. So you had a candidate who already was viewed by a faction of the electorate as disqualifying or not someone on the Republican side that they wanted to show up and cast their ballots for in a special election, much less even in an ordinary election. I do think, though, that one of the most striking themes on the Republican side was that Donald Trump's approval rating in Alabama, a state that he won by nearly 30 points, was split fairly evenly with, you know, somewhere between 47-48% of Alabamians approving, 48% of voters there approving of his job performance, and 47% saying they did not, which is a stark contrast, and I think in some ways an indication that his late-stage support for Roy Moore may have actually cost Moore rather than helped him.
I want to give a listen to Wisconsin Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Here he was talking to reporters in the Capitol hallway earlier today.
What message did the election send last night?
The Alabamas didn't want somebody who dated 14-year-old girls.
I mean, is this a lesson for Steve Bannon?
I hope he pays attention that you need good candidates to win Senate races, yeah.
So is this a lesson for Steve Bannon? He was asked there. And Steve Bannon, former advisor to President Trump's campaign, to President Trump as president, and now he had really hitched his star to Roy Moore as the first in a series of insurgent campaigns that were going to knock out establishment Republicans and kind of take over. What's the talk about Steve Bannon today?
Well, in my conversations with allies of Steve Bannon, they are not planning to slow down or to step back. Bannon is someone who vowed to challenge every incumbent Republican senator who is up for re-election in 2018, except for Ted Cruz, with whom they have better relations and who did back Trump in a public way after initially declining to support him. So I think that when it comes to the Bannon wing, Roy Moore's loss does not mean that you won't have other candidates who may have once operated more so on the fringe, but now are part of the Republican mainstream. And I think the fact that the president was willing to throw his support behind Roy Moore, that emboldens other candidates who may not have the qualifications or who may have made very controversial comments in the past to still believe that they ultimately have a shot at winning. And it still was a fairly close margin. We are talking about roughly a point and a half. Now, in a state like Alabama, it's so much more surprising because, as you said, this is a deeply red state that elected a pro-choice Democrat. But in some of the other battleground states or where there are vulnerable Republicans facing re-election, as mentioned, you might not have someone on the ballot who has such an egregious accusation that's been made against him or her. And so I think Bannon doesn't feel that every single race is going to mirror what we saw last night in Alabama. The real question will be, what will Republicans in Washington do? Will they embrace these candidates as they initially did with Roy Moore, or will they try to really take this fight on and try to reclaim what they believe is the soul of the Republican Party?
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui from The Guardian, looking at the big national news of the week, starting in Alabama and the surprising Democratic win there in the U.S. Senate race. Let's turn to the Democrats now, Sabrina. They had a long run of bad news. Now with the Virginia, New Jersey, now Alabama elections, they've got news. They've got actual wins they can point to. And some of the commentary I've seen, and I can't remember who to attribute this to, was this could make recruiting candidates for Democrats much easier. If people are reluctant and tough Democrats, Democrats can say, point to Alabama and say, if Democrats can make it there, they can make it anywhere. Do you see a lot more people maybe coming forward to run for office for the Democrats after this?
I do think so. It was notable that Doug Jones took some time out in his victory speech to really acknowledge that he himself didn't think that this was feasible, and he was very reluctant to run for this seat. And it took a lot of convincing because it's not easy for these centrist or more moderate Democrats, blue dog Democrats, this diminishing breed, to feel like they can compete in this highly polarized environment. But what Doug Jones was able to do was prove that if you run a smart campaign and you don't nationalize it, that if you really focus on local issues, but also on Democratic turnout, then it certainly is possible to mount a credible challenge. And I think the fact that women, especially African-American women and African-American voters more broadly, made a big difference, that's something that Democrats can replicate in other states. Because once, as much as people try to characterize Alabama as this very deeply conservative state, it still has the same rural-urban divide that many states across America continue to hold. And that's where Democrats have an opportunity to engage and register and get the voters to participate, who often don't in off-year elections and only do in presidential races. And that very much speaks to African-American voters, Hispanic voters, millennials, and single women, some of the voters who Doug Jones targeted successfully last night.
Want to move on to what turns out to be a related issue. We're hearing that a tax deal has been reached between House Republicans and Senate Republicans. Now, Democrats are saying, and I don't think Republicans are listening so far, hey, hold off on any kind of Senate vote until the new guy is seated, Doug Jones from Alabama. Is there any kind of indication that Republicans would hold off if they do have a compromise deal that they could vote on?
Republicans have already been quick to rule out operating off any new timeline. I think they are eager to get this through. I think, if anything, the election has put even more pressure on Republicans to pass this bill because they are now looking at an even slimmer majority in the Senate. It's down now from 52 to 51, meaning each individual senator has a lot more potential to influence the direction of the bill and to raise concerns and to gain concessions. And so I think they really want to move forward now that they've ironed out a compromise. There still are some senators on the Republican end who have ongoing concerns. So they certainly have not corralled the votes that they need just yet. But I don't think, and even some of the Republican holdouts on the tax bill, even they have said that they don't believe that they need to wait for a Senator Doug Jones to arrive. And I think Republicans, they're looking at the math, and I don't think that they have any appetite to prolong this any further.
We're talking to Sabrina Siddiqui. She's a political reporter for The Guardian. She's with us to recap some of the top national news stories of the week.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. With the Senate and House reaching an agreement on a tax overhaul plan, what do you think about that plan? What do you think about the president's tweet aimed at Senator Kirsten Gillibrand? And should Trump be investigated for allegations of sexual harassment, as nearly 60 congresswomen have requested? You can let us know right now by calling 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the latest political stories, the biggest ones of the week. Sabrina Siddiqui is with us from The Guardian.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Republicans should respond to allegations of sexual harassment against President Trump and calls for some kind of investigation? Do you think there are conflicts of interest in Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election interference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi. As a conservative, in a lot of ways, I enjoy what is going on with the tax plan and other things in Washington and the deregulation. But I must say that if they can investigate current senators for misconduct from more than 5 or 6 years ago, why not investigate Donald Trump? He should be held to the same standards as the other people.
Charlie, thanks for that call. And Sabrina, we've heard calls from some of Donald Trump's accusers, followed by a bunch of women in Congress, mostly women in Congress, for investigations into Donald Trump's allegations of sexual harassment. Some senators calling for his resignation. We'll get into that more. Can you talk about some of the latest going on there this week?
Well, I think that the point just raised is one that Republicans have really struggled with, as they have called for accountability for those who've been accused of sexual misconduct, and as they called for Al Franken to resign alongside Democrats who eventually did the same. Why is it that they are not holding the president to the same standard? That question even came up when many of the Republicans were saying that Roy Moore should not be elected to the Senate due to the allegations that he was facing as well. And I think that it just puts them in an awkward position because they're reluctant to take on the president. There really is no clear explanation that they have provided other than that the American people voted for Trump anyway in the election, even though they were aware of the allegations that were looming over him and his campaign. So I think a lot of it at this point is really symbolic, especially on the part of Democrats who now want to weaponize this as a form of hypocrisy, or what they believe is hypocrisy, on the part of Republicans, where there you have this watershed moment around sexual harassment. And it is clear that the president is being viewed as operating under a different set of rules than the other powerful men who have been accused across multiple industries, not just politics, but also media and entertainment.
Let's move on to a related note now. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was one of the Democratic senators. She's from New York, calling on the president to resign over the sexual harassment allegations. The president tweeted that Gillibrand had come to his office in the past begging for campaign contributions and, quote, would do anything for them. Can you talk about the reaction to especially that part of his tweet?
Well, I think it was immediately interpreted as a form of sexual innuendo and a highly gendered remark, because Kirsten Gillibrand was one of four Democratic senators who in recent days called on the president to resign. The other three, Cory Booker, Jeff Merkley, and Bernie Sanders, were all men. And the president noticeably only attacked Senator Gillibrand and did so, as you just read out, in a very suggestive terms. Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, insisted that he did not mean anything by it, that only people whose mind is in the gutter would read it that way. But frankly, not just Democrats, Republicans read it that way too. Conservatives, I think conservative commentators felt that it was unhelpful at a minimum and inappropriate for the president to use such terms about a sitting U.S. senator, a female senator. And it certainly put even more of a spotlight on the president's misconduct or allegations that he is guilty of misconduct. If he wanted to steer the conversation away from his accusers, casting a spotlight on his treatment of women is not the way to do it.
I want to give a listen to Senator Gillibrand addressing the president's tweet this morning on NBC.
It was certainly just a sexist smear intended to silence me. And I'm not going to be silenced on this issue. I've heard the testimony of many women, numerous accusers. I believe them. And he should resign for that. I think Congress should do an investigation because we need accountability.
Now, for Congress to do an investigation, Republicans, since they're in the majority, I assume, Sabrina, would have to sign on. I don't know exactly how these things work. Any sign that Republican leadership would be interested in doing something like that?
No. In fact, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was asked this very question, and he said that there are no plans to pursue such an investigation. Republicans are squarely focused on their agenda. And that includes the tax reform bill that we were just discussing moments ago. They failed in multiple attempts to repeal and replace the health care law. And so I think that they're very eager for some sort of legislative victory, especially as they close out now nearly 1 year where they have controlled both the House and the Senate as well as the presidency. So I think that they recognize that taking on not just any president, but this president in particular, who has been more than willing to engage in high-profile feuds with members of his own party, would be politically damaging for them. The question, of course, becomes, will it also then be politically damaging that they are not holding him accountable as Democrats go into the upcoming midterm elections with what will undoubtedly be an argument that in this national dialogue around sexual harassment and sexual assault, Republicans were unwilling to address the allegations against the president. It remains to be seen how much of an issue it becomes, but I do think that you're not going to hear any change in tune on the part of Republicans. It's just not a place that they want to go or that they feel comfortable going.
Sabrina Siddiqui is with us from The Guardian. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. We'll go back to our callers on that tax and health care issue you were just talking about, Sabrina. Amelia is with us in Montello. Amelia, hi.
Hi. I heard on a news report this morning that if the tax bill goes through, 24 million people would be thrown off of health insurance. Does this mean that the individual mandate is definitely being taken away? And if so, will the subsidies also be taken away?
Amelia, thanks. I assume details are still coming out, Sabrina, but what do you know about health care and the individual mandate in this tax compromise?
Well, as you mentioned, they are still working on the compromise, so it could change at any moment. But as of now, yes, it would still repeal Obamacare's individual mandate. And that, of course, applies to the penalty that individuals would incur unless they buy insurance. It certainly weakens the healthcare law's marketplaces, which are already in a sensitive and uncertain spot by reducing how many people would be covered. But I think that the exchanges themselves are not being targeted under this tax bill because they have to keep it within certain limits in order to pass it through the reconciliation process that allows them to clear it on a simple majority vote. The person to watch here is Susan Collins. Now, she was skeptical about including an individual mandate repeal, and she said she would only support that if there was also an effort to stabilize the health insurance markets that were established under the Affordable Care Act. And it's not clear at this moment that Republicans are going to meet that promise. So is that going to be grounds for her to vote against this bill? They can only afford to lose two votes. Any more than that would sink its chances of passing.
Amelia, thanks for the call. I want to touch on one more issue before we're done, Sabrina. President Trump's lawyers, some of his personal lawyers, called this week for the appointment of a special counsel to investigate the special counsel, Robert Mueller, who's looking into the Russian election interference and the Trump campaign. Why are they asking for an investigation of the investigators?
Well, there have been reports that detail private text messages sent between two former investigators on Robert Mueller's team that appear to show an anti-Trump bias. The texts were certainly critical of Trump, and so Trump's allies have seized on this as evidence that there is bias within the special counsel's team. Now, one of those individuals, Peter Strzok, was removed from Mueller's team in late July because of the discovery of these texts. So I think it is highly unusual that they are now being offered to reporters and exposed in this public manner. I do think that so far, when you look at the indictments that Robert Mueller's team have handed down, they have been very carefully handled. They apply to a lot of the, or they back up a lot of the reporting that was initially out there about Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, and others, and their communications with the Russians. So it doesn't appear as though they have stepped out of bounds in any significant way. And today you had Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, testify on Capitol Hill, and he said he can't think of anyone better than Robert Mueller to handle this investigation. So I think the real question will be, are they now? Is this an attempt to lay the groundwork for firing Robert Mueller? That's the concern that some Republicans on Capitol Hill have held, that the president might try to remove the special counsel. And this could be some of the early stages where they are trying to lay out some sort of rationale by exposing some of these private exchanges, even if they were handled internally by all accounts.
And tomorrow after 4:30, we'll take a deeper look at where that investigation stands with a professor of political science at Marquette University. That's tomorrow at 4:30. And Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sabrina Siddiqui. She's a political reporter for The Guardian. She's with us for a look at some of the week's biggest stories in national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. First, floods have struck communities around the state this year, from Racine County to Minocqua. A group of UW-Madison researchers wants officials to understand the threat that extreme flooding could pose to other Wisconsin cities.
But instead of making projections about hypothetical storms, they decided to take a storm that had already happened and move it into another city using computer modeling.
Scott Gordon has more in the next installment of our series, State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin.
The storms that went through the Wisconsin Dells in June of 2008 destroyed homes, disrupted the area's tourism industry, and caused Lake Delton to empty out into the Wisconsin River.
And we are looking out over the lake, and we see these houses tumbling in. And it was just the most surreal thing because our lake was gone. Our lake was gone.
That's Don Baker, who owns a resort on the shores of Lake Delton.
And it was early June. Our season had just started, and our lake, like our best friend, was gone, you know? And it was just the scariest thing ever.
Researchers think that climate change will bring more rain and flooding to the Midwest in the years to come. The challenge is in making that prediction seem real. Enter Ken Potter, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He worked with students to create a computer model of the 2008 flood in the Dells, but they moved the same storm just a little ways to the south, to Madison.
And the results would have been devastating.
It's tough to predict what exactly would happen. But in the worst case, the model found that such a flood would cause Lake Mendota to overflow its banks, flood large portions of downtown, and close down the Dane County Regional Airport.
Climate change is going to increase the intensity and amount of rainfall. We don't know the details, but we know that these things will increase. And the real issue is, how do you get decision makers to act?
Potter wanted to get people's attention. He also hoped that the models would help emergency officials and city engineers think about how to bolster their city's infrastructure and emergency plans. By identifying some weak points, a city could do more to prevent catastrophic events like a dam breaking. For Potter, the model isn't just about driving home the realities of climate change. It's about the choices that people can still make to adapt.
So I think it's a recognition that, hey, look, the climate's changing. We also are urbanizing. We need to de-urbanize better and keep in mind how climate's changing.
To some extent, cities are stuck with decisions made decades ago. Greg Fries is assistant city engineer for the city of Madison. He says large portions of central Madison are prone to flooding, and it's hard to go in and put in new storm sewers that could carry away more water.
For the downtown area, we are largely living with a system that was designed, you know, in some cases, almost 100 years ago, or more, actually.
Fries says as the city expands with new development, it can build better storm sewers. Madison can also require buildings in flood-prone areas to have higher foundations, among other things. For Ken Potter, the big lesson is that people can't control rainfall, but still have a lot of say in where rainwater ends up.
And I think the thing I'm hoping they're learning is that also contributing to increased flooding is urban development. If we convert the landscape from soil, agricultural soil, to rooftop, to street, to parking lot, we're going to greatly increase the amount of runoff.
Researchers like Potter caution that a computer model can only predict so much. But the floods of 2017 have driven home the reality of climate change and a wetter world. Scott Gordon, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This report was produced in collaboration with WisConText, a service of Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television, and the University of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension. You can learn more about the issue at wiscontext.org.
This week, many workplaces will be hosting their annual holiday parties, but the events are changing and are becoming more, in many cases, toned down.
For some workplaces, gone are the days of the Christmas party with free-flowing alcohol and potentially embarrassing karaoke with your coworkers. Here is an example, a fictional example, from Bridget Jones's diary.
And for various slightly unfair reasons relating to this year's Christmas party, I suspect he does not fantasize about me.
This year, some managers and HR departments are changing their approach to the office holiday party. The human resources and outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas Inc. found that the number of companies serving alcohol has dropped from last year's 62%, this year about 49%.
Nancy Johnson is director of the Human Resource Management Program at Madison College. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So as we just heard, a pop culture fictional representation of holiday parties. It's certainly a mainstay. They have been depicted in the past as a way to let people let loose, maybe sometimes a little too loose. Is that often a concern in real life?
Well, I think in real life, there have been plenty of people who've had their careers come to a screeching halt after the Christmas party. And so I think that fictional description is actually a thing of the past.
Okay, so that might not be something that you would see today. So do you think that there might be just sort of a sea change in how coworkers, you know, maybe approach holiday parties?
Absolutely. And I think in just a couple of words, it would be more casual. So I think the idea of spending lots of money on clothes and babysitters for a Saturday night bash with coworkers and trying to be all buttoned down and polished, that just is the past. And I think more people are interested in a lighter, more casual sort of thing.
Maybe a little bit less hands-on, maybe. So do you think there might be a new pressure on human resources department during the holiday season around these parties?
Well, human resources people have been coming to the fore recently with recent stories about sexual harassment in the workplace. And I think it's important to remember that the job of HR people is to create a positive work environment. And so that means during holiday parties as well as regular work time.
We are talking to Nancy Johnson right now. She is the program director of the Human Resource Management Program at Madison College. And we're talking about the ever-present holiday party and how it's been changing over the years. And human resources and outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas Inc. found that 49% of office parties won't be serving alcohol. And that's a big drop from last year because they reported it was about 62%. Why are employers moving away from serving booze at these parties?
Well, I think, first of all, the millennials are the ones that make up the bulk of the current workforce, and they're more interested in a casual sort of thing, and so companies are transitioning from a fancy evening kind of affair more to a lunch sort of thing, or maybe a reception kind of thing after work and actually in the workplace. Lots of workplaces have really lovely facilities, and so people who have long commutes find it convenient to just gather with their coworkers right after work and call it a day.
Sure. So as you mentioned earlier, not having to find a babysitter, not having to get dressed up, not having to maybe get rid of your Saturday night to attend one of these parties. So are there any other ways that millennials might be really like further affecting this lifestyle? Choices might be different?
Well, certainly millennials are very interested in health, fitness, concerns about food, and so the kind of just let it all hang out sort of parties are gone, and instead there's a lot of sensitivity to people's dietary needs and preferences. There's sugar-free, gluten-free foods for vegans and so on, and so the food aspect has certainly become more healthful, I think, and done in the workplace.
And I also, from what I've read, there's been the inclusivity goes beyond just maybe dietary issues, but also wanting to make sure that if you're not Christian, you may not be celebrating Christmas,
absolutely.
That everyone gets to participate.
Yeah, absolutely. When we think about the holiday season, we start with Thanksgiving and Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, New Year's, all of that. And not everybody is going to be celebrating Christmas. And so with diverse workplaces, I think there's a real concerted effort on the part of managers and HR people to make everybody feel included. And in the old days, maybe when you'd have just a few people with a tradition that was non-Christian, they could feel left out, and quite candidly, I think they were just ignored. But that's not the case anymore, and I think there's a real focus on including everybody.
Sure. So we are talking right now to Nancy Johnson. She is the director of the Human Resource Management Program at Madison College, and we're looking at how office holiday parties are changing as HR departments come under a little bit more scrutiny these days.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is your workplace having a holiday party this year? Is it something that you used to do in the past and have canceled? Do you look forward to or dread the holiday party? Have you seen changes in the presence of alcohol? And were there problems in the old days? Did things get out of hand? Do they still at your workplace holiday parties, or are they pretty mellow events? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Nancy Johnson. She's the director of the Human Resource Management Program at Madison College. And we're looking at workplace holiday parties and how they're changing.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How does your workplace handle holiday parties? Are they big, expensive affairs? Just a quick check-in over lunch or maybe right after work? Have you seen a change over the years? Less alcohol, less wild times, or are they still pretty out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we're going to go to one of our callers right now. We have Adam in Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Yes, hi.
And what did you want to say about holiday Christmas, or just holiday parties?
Well, I have a startup company, and I'm going to be hiring artists. And I like to have parties, but I'm very alcohol conscious. And so I had the idea of, you know, let the employees know this is a number one party, very little alcohol, or this is a number 10 party where everybody's just going to get smashed. Is there a way of protecting myself from liability?
Okay, so thank you for that call, Adam. So he has a couple things going on there, you know, asking or wanting to know whether or not he should let his employees know it's going to be a number one party to maybe a number 10 party, where the spectrum of alcohol consumption is going to maybe vary a fair amount, and also how to protect himself. What are your thoughts?
Well, Adam, I certainly appreciate your concern. The last thing you want is a headline that has your company's name and associated with somebody who maybe picked up a drunk driving ticket after being at your party, or even worse. Actually, one of the things that I think you might consider is if you're going to be serving alcohol at a party, put the food out first and let people have a chance to have a little bite to eat, and then put the booze out and spend some money and have a bartender, or at least have a specific time for when you're going to be serving the booze. I'd really caution you against just no holds barred, just the kind of party where everybody gets completely smashed. I think that would be a big problem, could become a big problem for you. So a little food to start off with, and then a limitation on the booze without being too heavy-handed about it.
And we talked about this just a few minutes ago about the use of alcohol or having alcohol at parties has gone down a fair amount, with there being some concern of, you know, maybe an uptick in sexual harassment. Are we seeing a little bit of a Harvey Weinstein effect right now with people being concerned?
It's probably the case. And it'll probably be after the holidays that we really find out about the Harvey Weinstein effect. One of the things I was reading about is that some companies are actually having monitors at their parties, and that feels a little unfriendly to me. It's unfortunate that we have to think about having a hall monitor for a company event, but I think some companies are going to that extent
as a way to safeguard themselves, maybe.
That's
right.
Correct.
Now.
Right.
We're talking to Nancy Johnson right now. She is the program director of the Human Resource Management Program at Madison College, talking about maybe some of the pitfalls of holiday parties, but also how you can still have a good time. We're going to go back to the callers right now. We have Chris in Sussex. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
And what'd you have to say, Chris?
Well, earlier you mentioned that you think maybe part of the reason for the not parties is millennials and lunch and stuff, and I don't know. I don't know if that's the case, but I know for me, I've been fortunate enough over the years to be a stay-at-home mom, and I kind of looked forward to those holiday parties because it was a time to kind of get out and get a babysitter. And now my husband's company, which I would consider a medium to large-sized company, has decided to forego any party whatsoever, and I find it a little disappointing, but I think it's like liability reasons. One, like you said, the harassment stuff, maybe the drinking, if they get associated with the drinking, if something happened afterwards, and who knows what all people come up with nowadays. But
and what are your thoughts on that, Nancy?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that we're moving to a situation where we can't enjoy each other's company and we can't relax and socialize with coworkers. And I certainly appreciate your interest in having a night out with your husband's coworkers and that kind of thing. And it certainly is not a one-size-fits-all. I think there are going to be some companies that have a tradition of a big formal Saturday night event, and that's going to continue. One of the things that I think that might be helpful to organizations is to have a panel of employees and weigh in on, get employees to weigh in on what's going on. Certainly employers can lay out some parameters saying that we're interested in employees' ideas. What are the parameters? Are we going to include family members? What level of alcohol or non-alcohol is going to be there? Some companies have recognized that the holiday season between Thanksgiving and New Year's is so busy that they say it's just too much to ask employees to be doing one more thing. So they actually shift to January, when January is a little bit calmer, and they shift the time there. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, and I think these days it's really helpful to hear the voices of the employees who are part of the organization.
And we're going to go back to our callers one more time. Mark and Racine. Hi, Mark.
Yep. Hi.
And what do you have to say?
Well, one thing I wanted to say was that a lot of the places I've worked have booked hotels so people don't have to drink and drive. They have a hotel paid for them, right? And it's usually adjoining the banquet room. So I think that's the way to go if you're going to have any alcohol. At a party. Either that or I just thought that perhaps the company pays for Uber rides back to your home.
I think that's a great idea. And certainly if people have their party in the facility where they're going to be staying the night, that sounds like a great solution. And an elegant celebratory kind of thing that would certainly appeal to the caller that was just before you.
For that person who kind of misses going to the holiday parties, getting away maybe from the kids, going out on a night out. Now, I want to go back to something that you talked about, which was tapping into your businesses should tap into their employees, maybe going more of a bottom up versus a top down approach to these parties.
Well, I think it's a mistake to assume that HR folks or CEOs have all the answers. Sometimes we don't even have all the questions. And I find it very, very helpful to have a group of employees serve on a panel. Perhaps they could be an advisory board to the HR department, meet once a quarter for an hour or two, hear what's on people's minds, and it's a great way for companies to stay in touch with what employees are thinking about.
And do you think that businesses would be open to those sort of advisory panels, or is it maybe sometimes hard to relinquish your holiday party control?
Well, that doesn't mean that you're relinquishing your party control. You could certainly say, you know, these are the parameters. This is the amount of money we'll spend. This is the amount of time we're going to spend. But there's a remarkable amount of creativity among employees, and employees like to be asked.
And for employees who are maybe heading to these parties throughout the next few weeks, what advice do you have for them to have a good time with their coworkers?
Well, one of the things that they might consider is to have a little something to eat before they leave, so that if they're offered a drink when they first walk in the door, they have a little foundation. Set a time when you're going to leave. If you're at the party with a spouse or a family member or a friend, maybe you can have a nonverbal signal about when it's time to leave or when you need to move on and talk to someone else. When my husband and I would go to my Christmas parties when I was in a corporate situation in a former life, I spent a lot of time saying the names of my coworkers and rehearsing the names of the spouses before we'd get to the party. So there's a little bit of homework that employees can do before they go to the party.
To be a successful party goer and a good coworker, it sounds like. Well, Nancy, we're going to leave it there for right now, but thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Nancy Johnson is the director of the Human Resource Management Program at Madison College, and she joined us today to talk about how office holiday parties are changing, especially as workplaces and HR departments are under a little bit more scrutiny. You can keep the conversation going at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Yeah, let us know what your workplace party is like, if there is one on the holidays, you look forward to it, if you would rather not go but feel like you have to, and let us know how your workplace handles issues like alcohol at the parties, driving, getting home, fun, and how much fun is too much fun. Again, let us know at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yesterday afternoon, we had a conversation about Netflix releasing some info about subscribers' viewing habits. We now know that a brave person somewhere in Canada watched Return of the King 361 times this year, maybe more by now.
But Netflix also sent out a tweet that put some people on the defensive. They wrote, quote, "To the 53 people who've watched A Christmas Prince every day for the past 18 days, who hurt you?"
Now, JC, we have some news. You did some research. You went on and watched The Christmas Prince.
I did. I actually went home after our conversation yesterday, had some time to kill as I was doing some other work stuff, and was like, you know what? I'm going to watch The Christmas Prince. I want to know what's going on with those 53 people and also maybe why Netflix had maybe this opinion of them.
And I'm guessing The Christmas Prince, a young woman, maybe overwhelmed at work, meets a prince around Christmas?
Sort of. I mean, you're in the ballpark, which I think says a lot that you can just based on the title alone, can maybe figure out what the plot is. It follows a journalist who was trying to get her big break, and she's sent on assignment. I do have some qualms with that being a somewhat forced cliche of the female journalist getting together with a source. But it was overall total escapism. I don't think that you should be ashamed if you've watched A Christmas Prince. I do not, so I can fall on that sword for other people. But
we'll talk to you in 18 days when you've watched it.
When I've watched it every single day and I've memorized everything.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.